This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, not in the sound-dampened Mouth Media Network studio, but instead standing in my apartment, and this is going to be a bit of a mixed bag episode of our show, a motley collection, if you will, as I weave together a few loose threads, puns intended. What you'll hear in this episode includes details of big upcoming sustainable fashion competition, short interviews with executives from Toshiba, YPRO, and C2RO Technologies, whom Kathy and I spoke with at the National Retail Federation's Big Show trade show last week, plus what and who I saw at the Textworld trade show earlier this week, and finally a bit about a fantastic exhibition opening at the Metropolitan Museum that I think a lot of designers will really get a lot out of. I realize many of you won't hear this before the event because people download and listen later, but just in case, we're at last call for tickets to the charity supporting event we're hosting live on stage at the Cutting Room Tuesday night, January 29th. It's the New York Fashion Week pregame show with two fantastic featured guests, Lauren Sherman from Business of Fashion and Gary Wassner from Interlux Holdings and Hilden Corporation. So if you've ever hung around with people who are watching football, often before the football game, there is a pregame show. And we are doing that for Fashion Week. They do it for football, why not fashion? So Kathy and I have obviously Lauren and Gary coming, who are amazing, and also some fantastic surprise guests that I cannot tell you about yet, but definitely grab a ticket at AmericanFashionPodcast.com or the charity site DesignFlaw.wtf. We hope to see you at the show. So I got this email. It's a press release, and it says the ninth cycle of the world's largest sustainable fashion design competition. So this is from Hong Kong, the Redress Design Award competition. First prize is a partnership with Chinese fashion giant JNBY Group, with the winner joining a design team to create a sustainable collection for retail. Second prize, a tailored mentorship with Orsolo De Castro, fashion designer, co-founder of Aesthetica, and co-founder of Fashion Revolution, which is amazing. So judges include Claire Press, who's the sustainability editor at Vogue Australia, again, Orsolo De Castro, and Ruth Farrell from Eastman, which is a European company, not Eastman Kodak. She's the global marketing director of textiles, so tough judges. They're adding menswear this time around, so if you heard of it before but couldn't enter because they didn't take menswear, that's an option now. March 14th is the deadline, and more info at redressdesignaward.com. Also from that group, check out redressdesignaward.com/learn for some circular design resources. Last week, Kathy and I went to NRF, the big show, which is put on annually by the National Retail Federation, much bigger than last year. Kathy and I were walking around in awe of both the scale and the change in scale. Retail technology is really heating up as a business. You can definitely hear more about that on our sister show, Fashion Is Your Business, which is also a podcast you can find online. Here are three short conversations we had with vendors at the show. WePro, an Indian IT services company, which is doing a lot of retail tech development in that space. Harry Shetty, global head of WePro's retail and digital practice. Also from Toshiba Global Commerce Solutions, Ashley Wyden and Tracy White, who are both account executives there. And from C2RO Technologies, which on their website says they do cloud robotics. You'll hear from Ricardo Badalone. We're here at the NRF trade show, the big show, National Retail Federation, and we are talking with Hari Shetty. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
Hari Shetty. From WePro, which is a technology company and provides a lot of technology for retail. Hi, Hari. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
Pretty good. This place is kind of overwhelming. I think this is the biggest I've seen the NRF big show so far. It's, I think, three times the size it was last year.
You know, I've been coming here for the last 15 years now, and I would definitely tell you this is the biggest crowd that I've seen here. and roughly about 40,000 people is what I hear are at the show today.
That's amazing. Now, is this because the business is changing, the retail business is changing?
Definitely, I see a lot of positive vibe across people who visit our booth here. I see a lot of energy, a lot of passion, and definitely the holiday season has been positive for a lot of our clients as well as our customers. And we see a lot of positivity in retail.
So everybody's in a good mood from the holidays?
Yes, absolutely. Everybody is in a good mood.
That helps.
So can you tell us a little bit about the solutions that WePro provides to the retail industry?
Retail as an industry, as we all know, is going through phenomenal changes in terms of transforming itself. And our services for retail is more on the technology side and the design side. So everything from reimagining the customer experience, designing the physical stores, combining that with the omnichannel experience, and providing a complete experience for customer is what we are doing for our clients.
So what specific kinds of technology do you deploy for your clients?
Technology-wise, a variety of technologies, right from, for example, we look at some of the emerging technologies like augmented reality, virtual reality, blockchain, personalization. You know, these are some of the things that we are sort of working on, helping with our customers implement a newer experience for their clients.
Now, are retailers already using blockchain technology?
Yes, they are. You know, interestingly, they are. And we see a lot of the adoption in the fresh industry, where fork-to-farm tracing is actually a very important element that is going on. And we have implementations of having done blockchain work in the retail industry, which are live and which are scaling up to the sizes that we require it to scale.
So this is being used to track the age of merchandise. So if something has grown on a farm, you track the life cycle of it?
There are two parts to it. Grocery is a big industry where we are seeing a lot of adoption of blockchain. And that's for tracing the freshness of the product. In a way, we also see a lot of adoption for high-value merchandise. For example, merchandise that is lost in theft, pilferage, duplicates, those kind of issues. We see a lot of use of blockchain, especially from making it tamper-proof and avoiding any issues with the product. We also see it in the healthcare industry. For example, the pharmacy supply chain, especially the temperature, the humidity, the vibration, where things of that nature are very important. We have a solution in our booth as well here, where we demonstrate as to how you can secure the supply chain using IoT blockchain as a technology.
Now, we're obviously a fashion industry podcast. What technologies is the fashion industry starting to use that they weren't using before?
There are a variety of technologies that are making a difference in the fashion industry. For example, shrinking the cycle time of product design is one of the key areas where we are doing a lot of work ourselves. This is all about how do you improve collaboration between the manufacturing side, the design side, and the retail side, right? And how do you cut down the cycle time in the industry? So we typically, it used to be like 10 samples, 15 samples of round turnaround times to actually get a product into the shelf. But then off late, with all the digital technologies that we can employ, it's a one cycle turnaround time. And we have been able to cut the cycle time from conception of a product to on the shelf from 6 months to about 6 to 8 weeks.
So how does your technology differ from other technologies that retailers or wholesalers, brands, may buy for product development?
See, the big component of the capability that was missing in this whole space was there are two parts to the design activity. One is the collaboration activity between designers and the manufacturers. The second part of it is visualization and the feel of the product itself. So the ability to visualize the product using some of the latest digital technologies is very different than what it was in the past. And using some of these technologies and giving the making it feel real is what is extremely important if you want to reduce the cycle time. And that's what we have been doing with our customers.
Your technology is doing all of that.
So I saw a robot in your booth. What's the robot doing?
Yeah, that's a very interesting solution. And let me give you some background on that. The biggest part of the industry that is actually growing very fast is buy online and pick up in store. Okay, roughly about 33% of all merchandise bought online is picked up in the store. But if you typically look at the challenge in the retail store, labor, with all the optimization that has happened, there's not enough labor in the store to cater to customer needs. Now, when you stack the online orders on top of that for the store labor, it absolutely puts a lot of pressure on the experience at the store level. So what we are doing in the robot is basically fulfilling online orders by making the robot do the rounds to pick up the items for the online orders. So the robot is watching the retail stores to see when the aisles are empty. And when the aisles are empty, it's running around picking up orders for the online customers and keeping it ready for them when they come to the store.
That's fantastic. So this is kind of replacing like the people in the Amazon warehouses who do the picking off the shelves. The robot will do that now?
Amazon's work is more on the warehouse side. The work that we are doing here and the robot that we are demonstrating here is on the store side. So it can be in a physical store and it picks up item through image recognition from a physical self and gets it back to the...
So that sounds more complicated than robots in a warehouse because obviously customers move product around and you've got to visualize the product with the machine to identify it. How are you overcoming those issues? Is that something you're working on a lot?
Yeah, the technology is based on image recognition. So the robot is aware of the planogram of the store. It also recognizes images. So when it gets a particular item to be picked up, it knows the image of that item. It goes looking around in the store for that item, and it uses the planogram as an indicator to figure out where the item is, and then picks up the item for the customer.
So is it picking up the item based on the image, the picture?
Yes.
That's amazing.
It's picking up based on the picture.
All right, thank you so much for your time. This is very interesting.
Thank you.
It's great. Nice meeting you.
So Kathy and I are here speaking with representatives of Toshiba, which makes quite a few retail systems. I'm here with Tracy White and Ashley Whedon. Hi, Tracy. How are you?
Great. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. It's been kind of a long day walking around. This is huge. We came to NRF last year, NRF, the big show. And this is probably three times the number of retailers and people in the space walking around. How are you, Ashley?
I'm great. How are you? My feet hurt a little bit, but it's been an awesome day.
That's a trade show for you. Ashley, what's your role with Toshiba and retail technology?
Absolutely. So I started with Toshiba back in August, and I have been in the retail industry for most of my life. Spent the last 5 years specializing in specialty retail software. And my role with Toshiba is I'm an account executive based out of Minnesota. I handle some of the Midwest and Western accounts. So dealing with the current clients as well as new business and kind of, you know, figuring out what their problems are and providing solutions to those problems.
What are some of those clients in general? What type of clients are those?
A lot of the clients involve, there's high volume retail, grocery, specialty, as well as, you know, some convenience stores, but it's really all over the spectrum of the retail industry. Yeah, hardline and soft lines.
Okay, and Tracy, what's your background and what do you do with Toshiba?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I started in retail in high school and college. So I started in the stores and went to FITM and got a merchandising degree there, finished my BA at Cal State Long Beach, and went into business and ultimately ended up selling retail technology, which I really love because when I worked in the store, we would beat the crap out of stuff. You know, we just didn't really care. We'd ride on the point of sale, slam things around, and it was so fabulous being on the other side and making sure everything was designed to handle that retail environment, which is so harsh. And coming from that retail background, I've been working in retail technology solutions my entire career, which is a very long time, which I won't say because I want you to know how old I am. But but it's just fabulous because, you know, kind of knowing a store what's going to happen. And it's so wonderful seeing all the new technologies for people. When I worked in the stores, if you didn't have the size, that was it. The person was going to leave. And you couldn't really do anything except call the other store. And you'd be online for like waiting for 20 minutes, you know, on hold. So we just didn't do that. It was like we have it or we don't. Come back in a week. Maybe it'll come in again, right? If we had a hot collection, it was gone. It was gone. Sorry. I hope my buyer buys it again. You know, I hope she's on top of it. And I always long for like a kiosk or something like, oh, I could just bring someone to and if get their size and save that sale. And we just quite frankly didn't have that back then. You know, it was more you had your book, you had your people's names written down and reach out to them. And so it's just lovely to see all the new technologies we have today.
I think a lot of stores are still kind of operating that way, and they're catching up, though. I mean, it seems like retail is really getting a surge here in change. There's just so many new technologies that are available and that are actually functional now, which is different. I mean, we've had the self-checkout things for a while, but they were all kind of clunky, and now you have beautiful ones that have they're available in different colors, not just gunmetal gray, which is really cool. Yeah, curved.
I think it's great with the technologies coming out, because to me, I've always loved being in the retail industry. It's very dynamic. You have to be totally sharp in retail, because if you're not on your A game, someone's going to come along and put you out of business. So everyone in retail is hardworking and creative and trying to give the best experience to their customers. And I think with the changes in retail nowadays, you know, with the online coming in, it's so exciting. You can give your customers more of an experience, really envelope them in your brand, really, you know, wrap your arms around them. You can now talk to your customers through social media, kind of understand what's hitting, what's not. So I think it's a fabulous time to be in retail.
So maybe talk about, and I love when you say wrapping your arms around your customer. So whether this is Tracy or for Ashley, like maybe even just the top two or three pieces of technology that you're loving for retail right now and that are enhancing the experience.
One of my favorite things is really the whole digital experiences with digital signage. A lot of retailers are having, those videos, not just videos up on the wall of their products, but they're actually becoming interactive. So the client can actually interact with those screens and interact with that technology within the store. And it just creates a whole new level of experience in the store. It kind of almost fuses the online experience and in-store experience. Because at the end of the day, you really are going to want to be in the store to try something on, have it there, not have to wait for it to be shipped. But at the same time, you could have the same experience in, you know, having control over shopping for what merchandise is in the store, just right at your fingertips, and selecting a size and having a sales associate bring it over to you. So those interactive digital displays have been really, really game-changing for a lot of retailers, not only just, you know, changing the whole store look and feel, but also that changing the experience. And I really think that retail is at the forefront of the technology revolution, because as consumer behaviors change, retail's got to keep up with it, and life has changed for everybody since technology has come. So shoppers are expecting stores to be with that technology. They're expecting stores to have an app. They're expecting stores to be able to buy online, pick up in store, ship to store, all of that. Customer expectations have, you know, really gone through the roof with technology, but it's also been able to keep the retail industry up with that by providing them with these solutions to really, you know, create that engaging experience that customers expect now with technology.
So it seems like there's probably been a big learning process going on with how much privacy that customers are willing to give up in exchange for this intelligence that the stores are getting, and how much information you really need to give customers and how much information they want about products and the backgrounds. What have been the big shifts that have come from learning that you've seen?
I was doing a beacon project with a customer, and they didn't end up going forward. I think if you would have asked me like 2 years ago, I would have thought beacon technology would have really taken off. And I think it hasn't because of some of the privacy.
What is beacon technology?
Oh, okay. Beacon technology is, if you think of how do I know a person's in my store, beacons go in the ceiling, it'll ping your phone, and it tells you, do you want to opt in? Do you want to tell me I'm here? Or you can set the retailer's app to say, you know, I want to know when I come in the store, you can let know I'm here. You can talk to my phone. So it allows a retailer, if you have to opt in, it allows a retailer to see where you are in the store and where you're going. So you could theoretically see all your customers that opt in. What areas of the store do they visit? What areas do they not? You know, where are my dead zones? You know, should I re-merchandise? So it kind of gives them, but that just, it didn't really take off. Now what we're seeing is more of this like, frictionless, you know, with the cameras getting so small and compute being put in the camera, it seems more going that way. But again, you know, you have to opt in and let someone know it's okay. So kind of seeing more of that kind of a trend. But I think privacy, I think that U.S. kind of lags Europe. I applaud Europe for all the privacy they're putting in place. One thing I want to call out is I notice when I'm online And let's say I'm working on something, and let's say I'm going to buy something, and I went to a retailer website, or I went a couple places kind of browsing. I get bombarded with ads from that retailer, even if I buy something from them. And I'm like, I just bought that from you. Leave me alone. But I'm like, obviously they're tracking me online and they know. So, I mean, first I want to call out, there's probably a lot of privacy setup that has to happen in the e-com space as well. I think a lot of people are going to start pushing back, like, I don't want you to target me, you know. And I think the stores as well. I think a lot of consumers, retailers have to be careful because you don't want a backlash. A lot of, like, with Facebook, it's got a lot of backlash from selling data, Google. You know, people are starting to become more aware. I think when technology came out, the thought was, this is great. It makes my life easy. I'm just going to get every single app there is. Now people are kind of taking a step back and going, wait a minute. I don't want ABC person to know this is my family and this is my anniversary and this is my birthday. Like, and people are starting to step back and really value their privacy and time out. You know, I want to control what you know about me. And I think that if retailers do a really good job with that, you know, customers will be good with that. But if retailers or different companies take people's data without their privacy, then people are going to push for legislation, and that's hard on everybody. So hopefully we keep those things in mind as we're, so we don't get creepy with technology. You know, there's a creepy factor where I might be fine if you know I'm in the store. I might be fine that you know this is my favorite brand and that, yes, that I'm buying these certain things together. And, okay, you know, you might know, okay, she loves this certain kind of boot, or she's a boot person. Every year she buys 4 pairs of boots. She loves boots, right? I'm fine with that. But I might not like you knowing I have 2 children and their ages and they shop with me and they also buy, you know, so you have to kind of be aware of where people's lines are and how they are, so don't get creepy. Like, or I walk in the store and you say, hi, Tracy, it's your birthday today. I might want to punch you. I might want nobody to know it's my birthday. I might not want you to know my name. It might freak me out if you're saying hi to me. So you have to have ways for people to tell you, where's the creepy zone and where do I want that attention, right? So I think that's a lot for people to think about as they're introducing these technologies. Be really aware of your customer base, what they want. Younger kind of demographics don't care as much as older. And, you know, they've grown up with technology. They're more comfortable with it. So just be aware as you're introducing these things, what your core clientele will like and not like and who you're targeting. And just be aware of that.
For those listening who aren't here at the trade show and want to engage with Toshiba and maybe look at some of your products, how can they connect with your team?
Right now we have an extra website called empoweringretail.com. as well as the Toshiba Commerce site. You can interact with us on both. You can see some of our different products, our different partners, some of the brands and logos that we currently are, you know, helping create that seamless experience today. So you can really see, you know, kind of what we've done. There's case studies as well as, you know, kind of just regular retail industry knowledge of, you know, what's trending in the technology, who's doing what's working, what's not, and, you know, some of the best practices in the industry.
We're speaking with Ricardo Badalone from C2RO Technologies. Hi, Ricardo. How are you?
I'm good. We're having a great show. Overwhelming amount of people coming to the booth. Super successful demos and technology deployments, so I'm really proud.
So your booth here is about facial recognition in retail. That's kind of identifying what customers walked into the store with a computer and tracking them. Can you talk to me, can you unpack that for our listeners?
Of course. So oftentimes analysis and recognition are conflated and confused. So when we say face recognition, we usually mean that we are explicitly recognizing a specific person. Most analysis systems that are analyzing for age and gender or tracking, you know, traffic are usually not specifically following an identified person. They're just analyzing the traffic flow. So we build a system that's cloud-based and real-time. So it's a global system that most companies that would have thousands of locations that want to be able to recognize thousands of customers would deploy. And philosophically, our platform is GDPR compliant, and so we respect privacy rules that have been started to be initiated in Europe.
That's the European Union's privacy laws that relate to Facebook keeping your data and all that, and they make Facebook and Google delete your data after a time, right?
Well, what it really means is that you cannot, without the permission and consent of the person, use their personal data. And not only do you have to get their consent, you should explain to them how your data will be used. Because even when they're consenting based on a premise and an understanding about how it's going to be used. So there's the spirit really centers around, if somebody wanted to, you know, have that customer participate in a recognition program that they had that could be tied to a loyalty program, usually the idea is to have a more frictionless experience or a more personalized experience. And of course, both are also good combined. So the way it usually works is you should ask the customer if they're okay with you using their face. Usually explain why you're going to use it. So for example, we're going to use this to recognize you in our stores and provide you with promotions and better service. And then the customer says, yeah, sure, that sounds good, and they opt in. And then at that point, you have their permission, and then you're free to recognize them even in Europe. All right, so again, you just have to be honest about what you're doing and honest about the benefits to the customer. And if the customer at any point in time says, no, I don't want to be recognized, then you have to disengage and flush all that data. And those rules are defined by the legislation that was passed in Europe.
Now, a lot of stores obviously already have security cameras in place. Are you using the existing camera and recording infrastructure of stores and just kind of connecting into that to run this sort of system?
Well, it turns out, so the answer is no. And there are two reasons for that. Primarily, the security cameras that are in stores are not good enough to specifically recognize a person with any kind of confidence. Now, it's not that the cameras are not high quality, it's that they were placed in that store to essentially surveil the surroundings. So you have a general sense of what's happening. But for a recognition system to be reliable, you have to have a certain quality, certain resolution, and you need to have a system that's essentially taking the image from the lens all the way to the neural network, which is the AI, and processing it in a very specific way. So usually the cameras that are doing recognition are dedicated for recognition, and they're strategically located and placed in the store so that you can get a good quality face when the person arrives.
And how do you get the person's permission? Is that at the register?
Well, if we're talking about explicit opt-in systems, there's a couple of different ways. You can get the customer to opt in a kiosk environment. And so if they're, looking through a web interface in the store, you could get their permission in that sense. Most companies today are using their mobile applications to get customers to opt in to a new level of service. So a cosmetics company might have an app, and in that app, you're constantly looking at yourself, you're trying on different augmented reality functions where you can see yourself wearing different makeup. Then at some point they may prompt you and say, listen, we want to be able to offer you follow-ups on what you did today in store, or maybe accent certain shades that are important to you in store. Are you willing to give us permission to use your face for that? And of course, most young people will say, yeah, that sounds awesome. And through the mobile, they'll connect the image and the name, and then that'll go to the cloud. And now any store that they'll walk into, which is the power of the cloud, will automatically recognize them using our technology.
So what are the top two ways a retailer uses this recognition? To greet the customer by name, or how is it being utilized?
We have three use cases. One of them is deployed today, and then the other two are in pilots and in discussions with customers. And by the way, because recognition is an opt-in, and it's very tied into the CRM, which is, where they have all the information about the customer, it generally, the stages are early pilot testing of even making sure it works, then pilot testing with a beta testing group of customers, and then you can imagine, you know, a rollout. So it doesn't happen overnight. But the three things are clienteling. So you have important customers that arrive. The associate, you know, gets an immediate overview of who that is or the history of that person. And we're using this in very high-end retail or resort environments. And this is deployed today in production. And so now the associate, never having met the person, immediately in real time has a history of who they are, and they can offer a much better service. So that's number one. Number two is the in-store experience is used to connect the online and the mobile. And so many cosmetics companies, for example, have a lot of data and information about you on their online and on your mobile. But when you're in-store, if they're a brand that is selling and they don't have their own retail environment, they have no idea that you're even in front of their product at any time. And so the value to them is that now that triangle is connected. The value to the customer is that they can get that personalized service where, you know, there's a row, an endless row of lipstick and blush. Now they're looking for something a little bit more concise. And so that's an opportunity in that where, you know, those types of brands can do that. And then you have commodities. So, for example, coffee. How many people are waiting at the drive-thru to get a coffee? Every morning you're getting a coffee. It's a $3 purchase. That company has a certain amount of time to get as many $3 purchases done before everybody's at work, right? So that's about reducing friction. You're going there regularly. You have a mobile app. They have your credit card information. Like, listen, if you just allowed us to recognize you when you arrive, we can cut and save all kinds of time. We'll make a fast line for you, you know, to promote the technology. And everybody who's using the technology in the fast line gets their coffee in 1 minute. Everybody else is waiting, you know. So those are the three really important. Now, all of those use cases have tremendous scale. And you don't want that recognition happening in the drive-thru kiosk or in the little display that's in the store in the cosmetics stand. You want it in the cloud, one place, tied to your business, secure and globally scalable. And that's what we've built. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yes, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
All right, so Tex World. I dropped in for a few hours on Tuesday to check it out. Tex World is a big textile trade show here in New York, but so many overseas textile vendors. You go down the rows and it's China, Korea, Bangladesh, China, Korea, Bangladesh, over and over and over and over. Fairly disappointing for me. And also, I think for designers who want to source domestically, source materials, it just wasn't an option at all to pick Made in USA textiles up from this show. So now, of course, we make a lot of textiles here in the USA, so why those Made in USA textile companies were not represented at TexWorld, I really don't know. The poor folks from the nonprofit Alliance for American Manufacturing, who do wonderful work, were oddly placed in a booth in the middle of all that with their big Keep It Made in USA banners staring down Chinese textile vendors, which was a little weird. But anyway, if you who are listening source textiles from a domestic manufacturer, I am so curious about this. Please ask them why they aren't showing up at the biggest textile show in New York. We really need them to show up. We need Made in USA presence at the trade shows, at all of the fashion trade shows. So if you get any odd answers or interesting answers, I'd love to hear about them. 646-979-8709 is our voicemail line. You can also email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com or message us on Instagram @AmericanFashionShow. Okay, so more about Tex World. I heard that the seminars were really packed, so people couldn't even get into the rooms, which I think is a great thing. There's education stuff going on, and people were really eager to get it. So those were being programmed from an area called Resource Row, and there were a lot of familiar faces there. I saw Stephanie Benedetto from Queen of Raw, Bruce Thompson from Bright Label, Rachel Kibbe from Helpsy, Brooklyn Fashion and Design Accelerator had a big presence, Fab Scrap, the textile recycling nonprofit here in New York City, was there. All these people have been on this show. I also got to meet somebody from Eco Textile Magazine. They were in town from England. I didn't even know that Eco Textile Magazine was a thing. And apparently they have a podcast too, so see if you can find that. Fashion Revolution had a booth. Fashion Index was there too. They publish a lot of directories and industry resource guides. And also I saw Melissa Shea and her team from Fashion Mingle, the new industry networking platform. They were at the end of the row running a series of mentoring sessions with some great experts. If you are an independent designer, I advise getting on the Fashion Mingle mailing list. Actually, I advise getting on the mailing list for every one of these groups. They do really cool stuff. So I'm going to put a bunch of links in the show notes and on our webpage for this episode so you can check them all out. So, you know, you don't have to remember all these names and the, I'm not going to say all the websites, but so there was also this area in Tech World called the Local Loft, where I ran into Patrick Duffy from Global Fashion Exchange. And also in his booth, I met Devin Gilmartin, who's the founder of Querencia Studio, a fashion brand building their business on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which is kind of cool. And he has some cool Made in USA t-shirts on his website, and there's a whole sustainable mission thing going on there. Maybe we can have him on the show soon to talk more about that. I also saw Chung Yu from MCM Enterprise, which is a factory in Brooklyn, and I see him at a lot of events, and I know they do a ton of domestic production right over in Brooklyn. Makers Row made some nice little videos with Chung a while back in his factory. I didn't see Makers Row at Tech World, but side note, definitely a fantastic resource for Made in USA. They help you find factories and suppliers. The website for that is makersrow.com. AGH Trim Source was there. David and David were in their booth. Their Trim Lab space is located on West 37th Street, and they supply a lot of trimmings, but in particular, go check out their YKK zipper library. Then next to them was a booth for In Vogue Studio, and print stylist Hilary Bach, who founded the company in 1993, was in the booth when I stopped by. The company is now operated by her son, Michael. In Vogue Studio does custom printing on fabric right in Midtown Manhattan, and also hand painting on fabric, but that's the smallest part of their business now. Hillary said they used to have 40 people doing hand painting of fabrics at one point, but that was years ago. Then I also met this guy, Tony Bajotti, from USA Beading, and I tried to record an interview with him, and something messed up with the recorder. So he makes, in New Jersey, beaded fabrics, and you usually think, oh, I want to get beading for this look, I have to go to India, but you don't. This guy has patented machine beading technology, and from what I saw at the show, it looks great. You really couldn't tell it wasn't like hand beaded. It was gorgeous. And again, I'll put all the various links in the show notes, but that's usabeading.com if you want to check that out. Also on Tuesday, I was at the Met. I was a press preview for Lucio Fontana on the Threshold, an exhibition at the Met Breuer and the Metropolitan Museum Fifth Avenue, which will be open from now to April 14th, 2019. I was really impressed, and I think a lot of you might like it too. And you may ask, what's the Met Breuer? Well, it used to be the Whitney Museum before they moved downtown to the Meatpacking District. And I had a bit of a deja vu thing walking in there before I realized why it was so familiar. And apparently the Frick Museum is going to be taking over that building sometime soon because the mansion where that collection is held needs to be renovated. And it's called the Breuer because that's the name of the Bauhaus movement architect who designed the building. But that's not important right now. So here's what the Met has to say about their exhibition. The first major survey of Lucio Fontana in the United States in more than 40 years, this exhibition re-examines the career of one of the most innovative artists of the 20th century. The Argentine-Italian artist is widely known for his Cuts series, slashed paintings that became symbols of the post-war era. The exhibition presents extraordinary examples of this iconic body of work. It also explores Fontana's beginnings as a sculptor, including his exquisite work in ceramic, as well as his pioneering environments, contextualizing the radical gesture of his cuts as part of the artist's broader search to integrate the space of art and the space of the viewer. So that's what the Met had to say, and they say it on their webpage, it's in the press release, all that. So he was born in 1899 in Argentina and died in 1968, I'm not sure where. But in between, this guy really developed some talent and contributed significantly to art movement, which defines still today how we see the world. The director of the Met read a quote from Fontana, and he said, "I don't want to make a painting, I want to open up space, creating new dimensions." So this was a man who was a sculptor until he was 51 years old, and then he suddenly switched to painting. Only he didn't switch so much as bring the entire sculptor's sensibility and toolkit to painting. His work is three-dimensional. In Buenos Aires in 1946, he co-wrote the White Manifesto, which is the first declaration of spatialism. That was 4 years before he jumped to painting. For his time, this guy was out there using new technologies and unusual materials. He was apparently the first artist ever to use neon light, and as you walk around the exhibition, you'll see crystals and swirls of plaster attached to canvases. One of these works, I just looked at it and had this thought, oh, all that junky, oversized art in hotel lobbies, they're trying to do this. So the pieces had an impact on me, and I hope they have an impact on you. There's also one, it's a ink on paper drawing of Medusa, and it's this female figure, and it's kind of chiaroscuro kind of thing, very intense. It was gorgeous. Many of the works on display appear charged with an inexplicable sense of energy, or at least potential energy. He used very mixed media, and the Cuts series, for which he's best known, for people who work in fabric, I expect this could be very inspiring. He created on solid color monochromatic canvases sumptuous curves with the flick of what must have been something like a machete. It's weird, it's interesting. So this guy was a powerful artist. If you see the show, you'll get why he was so influential, and I encourage you to go see the exhibition before it closes on April 14th. Thanks for listening to this somewhat odd hodgepodge episode. Remember to follow us on Instagram at American Fashion Show. We'll be back with another deep dive interview next week. To get on the guest list for our live events, go to AmericanFashionPodcast.com and look for the live shows link. AFPOD, AFPOD, is our Twitter handle, and I personally am fashion tech guru on just about everything. On Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, there's a Be a Guest form on the AmericanFashionPodcast.com website. For comments, our voicemail line is 646-979-8709. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and other episodes of the series, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.